We're going to move on now and finish out our morning talking about sarcomas, but also connective tissue neoplasms, which we've done a couple of CME programs in this arena that I found personally fascinating. I'm going to relate some of that to you, things I didn't know very much about, and I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't either. So today we have from the FCS, Frank Rodriguez from Cypress Lake, Florida. How's it going, Frank? Then Rich Riedel from Duke Cancer Institute in Durham, and Dr. Rashmi Chug from the Rogel Comprehensive Cancer Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to you all. And we're going to start out talking about connective tissue neoplasms. We're going to hold on the sarcomas for a second. And Rashmi is going to talk about a couple of very interesting entities that are, I guess, not really malignant, but certainly you're going to be treating in your clinical practice. So let's just dive into the data, and then Frank has a pretty interesting case I want to ask you about.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm really excited to talk about these locally aggressive connective tissue neoplasms, which typically have been thought of as being managed surgically, but we're beginning to be more involved as medical oncologists as more and more systemic therapies become available. So a few different types of these other connective tissue neoplasms. One is desmoid tumor. This is also known as desmoid fibromatosis or aggressive fibromatosis. Tenosynovial giant cell tumor, which was formerly known as pigmented villonodular synovitis, and then giant cell tumor bone. We're going to be focusing on the first two today and going to dive right in into desmoid tumors. So just to give you a little background, these are rare clonal proliferations of fibrous or scar-like tissues that can be fairly enhancing on T2-weighted imaging and really can occur anywhere in the body. So paraspinal, mesentery, abdominal wall, extremities, neck. They're fairly uncommon, and they have a very variable natural history that we'll talk about. They're more common in women, and they tend to affect patients in the third and fourth decade of life, but really can affect it at any time. And there's a few predisposing factors, one including familial adenomatous polyposis or Gardner syndrome, which is present in about 5 to 10% of patients with desmoid tumors, as well as antecedent trauma, such as surgery or pregnancy. The underlying pathophysiology of desmoid tumors really depend on dysregulation of the Wnt pathway, and this can occur with either in the sporadic type with mutations in the beta-catenin gene and in the case of FAP in the APC gene. Either way, both these mechanisms lead to accumulation of nuclear beta-catenin, which leads to downstream gene transcription in a pathway that's normally involved in wound healing and embryologically. There's a wide spectrum in desmoid tumors, both in terms of behavior, which ranging from asymptomatic to life-threatening, really. And there's also, likewise, a wide spectrum of therapies. And really, we need to have the therapies match up the behavior, so including local therapies. First, I'm going to talk about what's actually our first-line therapy, which is now observation or surveillance. This is now considered standard of care at diagnosis when surgery used to be the standard of care. A few exceptions, if there are severe symptoms at presentation that can't be controlled with symptom management, or if there's a significant morbidity, if there's progressive disease. This strategy is supported by multiple placebo control studies that really have shown that patients, even when they're progressing at presentation, do have evidence of stability or regression spontaneously. Also, a number of case series looking at surgery versus medical management have shown no significant difference in outcomes even 5 years out. So usually we resort to imaging or exam monitoring approximately every 6 months. Sometimes the first image is a little bit early. MRI is usually the method of choice. Before I jump into local therapies in desmoid tumors, I wanted to show you one of my patients who presented with a right hip desmoid tumor, a young woman that later on was found to have a lesion at her proximal thigh. And really what happened here demonstrates the infiltrative nature of these tumors, where we think it crawled along down the IT band to have a second nidus of tumor in the proximal thigh. And this just kind of illustrates why local therapies such as surgery, even radiation and ablative therapies can be problematic due to the infiltrative nature. Surgery nowadays is fairly rarely indicated due to the risk of morbidity and the high risk of recurrence, even with margin negativity. Radiation can be useful as it does achieve long-term control in a series of patients, but there is a relatively slow regression of the disease over years. And the risk of secondary malignancies in a tumor that's technically benign without metastatic potential is not insignificant. Cryoablation is becoming increasingly popular. There's some small series that show some benefit in small to moderate-sized lesions, and it essentially entails placing freezer probes into a tumor, but the exact role is still being defined. Jumping into systemic therapies, a lot of you may have heard of using anti-inflammatory treatments or anti-hormonal treatments for desmoid tumors. These have really poor quality data that's associated with them. No clear biomarkers, and a lot of people question their use. We still do sometimes use agents such as Sulindac or celecoxib or tamoxifen, but really the benefit is uncertain, so we really consider them if there's low urgency for benefit and a desire for minimal toxicities, along with the expectation of a relatively low chance of benefit. Getting into the systemic therapies we use more frequently, that they include the targeted therapies, including imatinib, sorafenib, sunitinib, and then some of the cytotoxic chemotherapies. And just wanted to point out, all of these agents, the studies have been relatively small, phase two or series, and response rates are kind of all over the map. The take-home point is that there are multiple agents, that there is some level of activity. If you're looking for the highest response rates, it comes with the highest morbidity. Doxorubicin and dacarbazine is a combination we use in malignant tumors, but if we're getting life-threatening effects, we often consider them here as well. We finally started doing some randomized studies in desmoid tumors. One of the first included the Alliance study of sorafenib versus placebo, and this took 87 patients that were progressing and showed a nice progression-free survival rate in sorafenib treated patients as compared to placebo, as well as an improved response rate. But important to note that even with placebo, we were seeing a 20% response rate as compared to sorafenib with 33%. Similarly, in the Desmopath study, we saw an improvement of pazopanib-treated patients over our traditional cytotoxic combination methotrexate and vinblastine with these patients. So our take-home message here was that there is activity of these TKIs in desmoid tumors, but really we have an exciting new treatment to talk about. In addition to dysregulation of the Wnt pathway, there's also significant dysregulation in the Notch pathway, which crosstalks with the Wnt signaling pathway. Gamma secretase inhibitors really affect this pathway, and nirogacestat is an oral gamma secretase inhibitor that has been studied in this landmark phase 3 study, the DeFi study, where basically patients with progressing desmoid tumors were randomized to nirogacestat versus placebo and were able to cross over at progressive disease. And during this study, we saw some really impressive benefits that we haven't seen before. This is a Kaplan-Meier curve showing some impressive progression-free survival benefit and this nice waterfall plot with significant tumor shrinkage rates of nirogacestat over placebo. The overall response rate of nirogacestat was 41% versus 8% in placebo. And there was a lot of really important quality of life measures that were evaluated, including pain and symptom burden, physical and role functioning, all that showed benefit. And there was also, interestingly, benefit seen across the poor prognosis subgroups. And this is a forest plot that really just looks at all subgroups that are studied, including those with APC mutations and prior TKI treatment, there is benefit seen. This is one of many questionnaires that were performed for patients that showed the significant impact of nirogacestat on pain. The blue line showing patients with nirogacestat treatment, showing a decrease in baseline pain that was sustained and happened pretty early on in treatment, as opposed to the patients with placebo in green. As in this population with a benign tumor, it's very important to consider adverse events. Nirogacestat compared to placebo had increased rates of diarrhea, nausea, fatigue, hypophosphatemia, rash, including hidradenitis suppurativa, was a significant side effect as well. In women of childbearing potential, ovarian dysfunction was also seen in 75%, which was defined as amenorrhea or premenopausal symptoms. Now, the majority of those patients, 75% at last report, resolved. All of them resolved once stopping nirogacestat treatment, but many of them resolved even during nirogacestat treatment. So this led to the first drug approval in desmoid tumors, which got many of us very excited. There's, of course, many unanswered questions and newer agents on the horizon. I'm going to jump over to tenosynovial giant cell tumor, which I'm guessing a lot of you haven't heard a ton about. But this is another rare condition of basically vascular proliferative inflammatory neoplastic synovial cells affecting a similar age group. There's two major types. The localized type is, as it sounds, more localized, and surgery is typically curative. The diffuse type can affect a whole joint and really have pretty high recurrence rates. The complications of this include pain, decreased mobility, and severe joint damage as these tumors grow. The underlying pathophysiology really is based on translocations in the CSF1 gene leading to CSF1 expression, and thus inhibiting this target has become very important. Therapies for this disease include localized surgery as standard of care, but unfortunately, despite this, there's a lot of recurrence tumors, and so we have resorted to systemic therapies, including anti-CSF1R therapies, traditionally have included imatinib and nilotinib, but more recently there's been more exciting drugs available. So pexidartinib is a selective inhibitor of CSF1R, KIT, and FLT3. This is a study design was used in Enliven, where basically patients with progressive disease were randomized to pexidartinib or placebo, and we're allowed to cross over. And we saw some exciting outcomes with response rates of 39% with pexidartinib as compared to placebo. Also endpoints such as tumor volume and clinical benefit was seen as well. So important, again, toxicities. A number of toxicities in this one, there was a small but real incidence of drug-induced liver injury, so patients needed to be enrolled in a risk mitigation program. Really excited to add that 2 weeks ago, we had our second drug approval for TGCT of vimseltinib, which is a switch-control tyrosine kinase inhibitor that's designed to selectively inhibit CSF1R. The outcomes were similar with responses at 40%, but notably, there was no drug-induced liver injury. And really, again, impressive waterfall plot showing nice tumor shrinkage and a prolonged duration of response. And again, really clinically meaningful endpoints with decreased issues with pain, improved range of motion, and so on. Last study I wanted to mention is there's a new highly selective next generation CSF1R inhibitor that was recently presented. This is preliminary data, but so far has really impressive response rates on the order of 54%. So excited to hear more about that drug as well. So with that, I summarize that, yes, we do need to know about these locally aggressive connective tissue neoplasms as there's more and more role of a medical oncologist in managing these with some of our newer agents.
Awesome. Thanks so much. So Frank, in a second, I'd like to hear about your 56-year-old woman. You know, we say in oncology, you wake up in the morning, you check your phone, you see what's approved, and then you start figuring out what to do about it. I'm sure when Valentine's Day, we saw vimseltinib and synovial giant cell tumor. I can barely pronounce it. It was another drug to consider. But Rich, I'm curious about your thoughts and experience with desmoid tumors before we hear about this case. I think it was about a year and a half ago, my team said, hey, you're going to be doing an hour and 45-minute interview session with Myrnal Gounder from Memorial on desmoid tumors, which I knew nothing about. And I'm like, how are we going to talk for an hour and 45 minutes on that? And we actually went over. There was so much to talk about. So many really amazing things. Just a couple things that stuck in my mind. I'm curious what your thought about is, you know, Rajmi talked about the 20% response rate in the placebo arm of the sorafenib trial. That wasn't like, that was for real. They actually, obviously they got placebo. These are spontaneous regressions. So I'm curious whether you've observed that and whether these are significant, and how do you know when somebody's going to have a spontaneous regression?
It's a great question, and the reality is that the treatment evolution, or that the treatment for desmoid tumors has completely evolved over the last 5 to 10 years. Started initially as case reports, anecdotal reports of spontaneous regressions, and really it was the phase 3 study by Dr. Gounder showing the 20% response rate in placebo that really, I think, solidified the fact that observation in the front line is appropriate for these patients. I've certainly seen it. I will tell you, anecdotally, we had a patient on a clinical trial who we watched a desmoid tumor shrink over 18 months, only to find out upon progression that that individual had been on placebo. So you think you know, but you know what they're on, but you don't. It's a fascinating disease state. There's guidelines. The desmoid tumor working group has a set of guidelines, and the initial guidelines that were published several years ago advocated for watching for at least 2 to 3 years before considering systemic therapy. It's hard to tell a patient sitting in front of you who may have a palpable or a visible mass, hey, we're going to sit and watch this. But I think as you delve into the data and patients are increasingly information gathering, they'll read information about high recurrence rates with surgeries, secondary malignancy effects with radiation therapy, long-term effects, and many patients are willing to observe, which I think is appropriate.
You know, another thing that's really interesting, Rashmi, is that they were able to pull off this phase 3 study in the pretty uncommon situation. And what, as I learned more about it, a lot of it had to do with this advocacy, patient advocacy group that really pushed this trial through. I noticed they had a lot of patient reported outcomes. You showed some of that, where you can literally see patients improving. What kind of symptoms do people typically have? And then what happens when you start to nirogacestat?
So pain is a big one, and that's pretty impactful when you take a patient population that's young and functional and, you know, is waking up at night or can't do activities. They have patients that can't carry their young children because of mobility issues. So those patient-reported outcomes were very meaningful to us as a community and really helped to gather the patient advocacy groups to help push this study and those endpoints over the finish line.
It's really amazing how we're seeing, you know, phase 3 studies in oncology, very uncommon. You start out with lung cancer with all the unusual mutations, and it seems like it's just spread throughout oncology. What a great thing. All right, well, let's see how this actually plays out in the real world. Frank, what happened with your 56-year-old lady?
Yeah, sure. So good morning. This is a 56-year-old woman who's the wife of a local surgeon. She's quite fit, quite active, and very young for 56. And she presented in mid-2022 with some discomfort in her left lateral thigh, no prior trauma. This became progressive, and eventually she was able to feel a mass that was kind of in the upper part of her hip, just over her maybe trochanter, greater trochanter, and radiating down the IT band. She thought, well, maybe it was related to some exercise she had done, but it got to the point where it was very uncomfortable, and she had some imaging. She had an ultrasound that showed a mass, a nodule about 1.5 centimeters by 2 centimeters along the IT band. She subsequently had an MRI that confirmed this left hip deep to the IT band mass, measuring about 2 centimeters, which was lateral to the vastus lateralis. And the differential diagnosis by the radiologist was either a fibroma or an elastoma. Unfortunately, her pain continued to worsen, so she was referred to an orthopedic oncologist because of the concern that maybe this could be something more based on the discomfort. She had a core needle biopsy done in May of 2023, and the pathology was consistent with a lipoma with fat necrosis. She continued to have worsening pain. They ended up doing an excisional biopsy of this mass, which showed desmoid fibromatosis with positive margins. Immunohistochemistry was positive for B-catenin and LEF1, both markers which are apparently pathognomonic of this disease. She did fine. She didn't really need anything else, but unfortunately, a couple of months after, now this is April of 2024, she had, again, some discomfort, and an MRI confirmed evidence of recurrence. So she was started then on nirogacestat at a dose of 150 milligrams twice a day. She didn't tolerate this very well. She had a lot of diarrhea that was not controlled by Imodium or Lamotil, and she also started to lose some hair, which was a huge deal for her. So at that point, we stopped, gave her a month off. All her symptoms resolved, and we restarted her at 100 milligrams twice a day, which she tolerated much better. Her quality of life went way up. But unfortunately, earlier this year, in about January, she started to feel some discomfort distal to the original site. And an MRI showed that there were a separate, discrete two foci. Her original known desmoid had improved, but she had two new foci on the medial aspect of the thigh around the vastus medialis in a totally different fascial plane. So she's still on therapy now. We're trying to figure out what to do next. If I had seen this before, maybe I wouldn't have even talked about maybe surgery, but my first thought was, can this be easily removed? So I guess the first question would be, what would be the role of surgery in what is now considered maybe a multifocal desmoid? Do we need to do a biopsy? Would radiation help? Does increasing the dose to 150 milligrams seem like a better option? And finally, what is the role of NGS, right? Is there any role to do an NGS test on this woman, as it may not necessarily inform the next step of therapy?
And I'll add to that, Rich, and maybe you can begin to comment on some of these questions. What do you see with core biopsies? And do you need it? How much tissue do you need? What about special tests that make the diagnosis?
There's a lot packed in there.
I know.
Thanks for the case. I guess I'll begin by saying I think there are a couple of options that can be considered, and a lot of this may be based on patient preference. At least at our institution, we really have moved away from surgical resection for these patients, given the high recurrence rates, oftentimes in excess of 50%. If you talk with our surgeons and in some of the guidelines, they still will consider surgery for disease maybe that's superficial in the abdominal wall. For multifocal disease or disease that's for multifocal disease in the thigh, my enthusiasm for surgery is low. My enthusiasm for radiation therapy is low, given that this is not expected to be a life-threatening disease state. And again, potential secondary malignancy risks associated with radiation therapy. If the patient is symptomatic, another local therapy like cryoablation, Dr. Chug alluded to, I think would certainly be reasonable to consider. There are other systemic therapies that could be considered if there continues to be tolerability issues with nirogacestat. NSAIDs for pain relief is certainly something that we will consider. It's not considered really to be disease modifying anymore. So I think there are a couple of potential options here.
Rashmi, third opinion. I think Frank brought up, would the TKI be a consideration? Sorafenib, increasing the dose back up of niro.
Certainly all interesting options to consider. You know, nirogacestat is more difficult to be tolerated in many patients. And even in the study, there was about a 40% rate of dose reduction. But anecdotally, a lot of my patients, I have started lower and escalating. Mm. You know, if they already didn't tolerate 150 milligrams twice daily, you know, and we want this disease to be one that they can live with, I wouldn't really try to escalate that again. I think it would be reasonable to consider switching to a TKI. Sorafenib we still use quite a bit of, and the nice thing about the sorafenib dosing in the Alliance study was it's at half the dose that we use for hepatocellular carcinoma, 400 milligrams daily, as opposed to pazopanib, which also has some activity, which we use at 800 milligrams daily. You know, if the symptoms aren't too challenging, since this is a new disease site, you know, managing symptomatically and seeing if this area starts to regress is reasonable, or I really like Rich's cryoablation idea, we're kind of zap the one that's not behaving and see if we can continue on the nirogacestat. So a lot of good options to consider.
Makes sense.
Frank, any other questions about it? Sounds like a challenging case.
Yeah, the challenge is really that it doesn't seem like it's a terrible issue to deal with, but for her, this is all she's focused on, right? So, and she keeps telling me, I want it out, and it's a difficult recommendation to make to have, you know, a surgery like that, when the likelihood is that, and I guess this comes with a question too, what is the likelihood that once you see a couple, you're going to end up seeing a fourth, a fifth, a sixth desmoid in that same person, right? This is a disease that is kind of like, you know, just the gift that keeps on giving, or do you normally see a couple sites of disease and then you see the disease stop?
Rich?
In general, multifocal disease, in my experience, is uncommon. It certainly can be associated for individuals who have FAP-associated desmoids. Mm-hmm. Those often will present with intra-abdominal mesenteric disease. So unclear if she's going to continue to develop lesions. Just to go back to the NGS question, I personally don't think that there's a role for NGS testing for this disease state. We know there are mutations in beta-catenin in 85-plus percent of patients. It's not clear to me that there are other drivers that would be worth exploring.
Okay.
So I also want to relate an interesting experience I had last week. We didn't really think about it when we were planning this. Another situation where people said, you're about to do a session on neurofibromas and this new drug that just got approved for that. And so I had the pleasure of working with Dr. Christopher Mortel from the University of Minnesota. I found out, incidentally, he's the son, I don't know if you ever heard of Charles Mortel. He was an iconic GI investigator. This is his son. He told me he wanted to do anything except go into medicine, seeing how hard his dad worked, but he ended up in there anyhow. So again, we spent almost 2 hours talking about neurofibroma, NF1-associated plexiform neurofibromas, Rajmi, which I now found out there's a new, you have MEK inhibitors that have been out there, and now there's a new one that just got approved. So here's some of the molecular things that he went through, and he considers it a rastopathy, which I never heard that term before. Went through the, you had selumetinib, which I guess has been used in pediatric NF1 and very successful. Now they have data in adults as well, though I think it's just approved in kids. And now this new one, again, a MEK inhibitor, which we kind of heard about with melanoma. This is mirdametinib, a MEK1-2 inhibitor. It seems pretty active. This is selumetinib. They both seem very active, although I guess at this point, mirdametinib is the only one that's approved for adults. So, Rich, anything you want to say on this whole arena? It seems really interesting.
Yeah, plexiform neurofibromas are a big challenge for patients with NF1. They can be disfiguring. They can cause significant pain. And we have an NF1 clinic at our institution, and my pediatric colleagues who run those clinics will see adults, but then they would send the adults to me, and I could not get selumetinib because it wasn't approved for adults. So I think this is a big win. Based on a phase 2 study, 114 patients, response rates about 40%.
Pretty good looking waterfall plot, too.
Very good looking waterfall plot. So I think excited about this as a potential option.
Rashmi, anything you want to add to that? And what about tolerability issues? With MEK inhibitors, I know there's some ophthalmic issues. We're actually doing a whole program on ophthalmic issues in oncology. There's so many different drugs now that affect the eyes. But what any experience with this, and what do you see in terms of tolerability?
So tolerability is variable with any of these agents. And again, when treating a benign disease that isn't so benign, we have to kind of balance our toxicities. Rash, with MEK inhibitors, can be pretty problematic. But, this is all about partnering with your specialty colleagues. So, your ophthalmologist, your dermatologist, and usually we're able to kind of get them through so they can get the benefit of, the decreased tumor volume and decreased pressure from their tumor.
Frank, you have anybody in your practice with NF1 plexiform neurofibroma?
Wait, I got six patients.
Six?
No. No. It's the first time I hear about it.
Me too. Yeah. I was like, whoa. It was the same thing. We got to an hour, 35 minutes. We were still going. I couldn't believe it. Anyhow, we maybe come back a little bit to Desmoid. We had a few cases, but let's move forward now and also talk about sarcomas. We'll see. We're getting a lot of questions from the audience as well. But Rich, if you could kind of review a little bit some of the newer data on sarcoma that is relevant to us here.
Yeah, perfect. Happy to. And recognizing that many of you probably do not see sarcomas in your practice, and if you do, my hope is that you partner with your local academic centers. We'll begin just first with a little bit of a primer regarding the disease. These are the objectives that I was asked to speak about. We'll talk a little bit about historically what the management was and how it's changed. I've been asked to sort of talk specifically about some advances in epithelioid sarcomas and synovial sarcoma, and then I'll end just introducing some preliminary findings and sort of ongoing trials and novel approaches. But for the uninitiated, we're talking about an extremely rare family of cancers. They can occur anywhere in the body. There are more than 100 different histologic subtypes with tremendous genetic diversity. About 15,000 cases a year, they account for about 1% of cancers in adults, and they can occur in soft tissue or bone. And we have a lot of challenges. We're challenged by the rarity of the disease. We're challenged by the histologic and genetic diversity of the disease. We're challenged by the fact that patients with advanced disease do poorly, and our treatment options are poor. with respect to systemic therapy for advanced disease, we're limited. We're limited both in terms of the number of treatment options. We're limited in terms of the effectiveness of those options. And so truly a disease state in significant need of advancement. Historically, what we used to do is if we had a clinical trial of a novel agent or a novel cytotoxic, we would enroll any patient with a diagnosis of sarcoma. And what that would result in is dozens of histologies being included on a study. Invariably, the study would be negative, and then we would be left scratching our head trying to understand why the study failed. We've started to change our philosophy over the last 10 years or so, and as a result, we're now starting to see the fruits of our labor. And there's clearly histologic subtypes of sarcoma that can respond differently to therapies. For example, paclitaxel has a response rate of 7% in unselected soft tissue sarcoma patient population. In cutaneous angiosarcoma, it exceeds 50%. Trabectodin and myxoid liposarcoma, the use of TKIs and GIST, the story sort of goes on and on as we've gotten a little bit smarter in doing histology-specific clinical trials. Between 1970 and 2012, how many FDA-approved agents do we have? One, doxorubicin. Here's what we've done just in the last 7 years or so. You can see close to 10, if not more, FDA-approved agents, all based on histology-specific studies. I've been asked to highlight tazemetostat in epithelioid sarcoma and then afami-cel in synovial sarcoma. So when we talk about epithelioid sarcoma, we really are talking about an ultra-rare sarcoma, and I suspect that no one in this audience has seen an epithelioid sarcoma, and if you have, it's probably the only one in your practice. This is an ultra-rare sarcoma, less than 300 cases a year in the country. There are two types, a proximal type, which typically occurs in older adults, a distal type that occurs in younger adults. And universally, the disease state is characterized by loss of INI1. That's seen in more than 90% of patients with the disease. And this results in an oncogenic dependence on EZH2, which is a transcriptional regulator. And as a result, the question was asked is, can we modulate that? Can we inhibit that? This led to an open-label registrational phase 2 study looking at tazemetostat. The study is shown here. It was a 62-patient study. You can see the vast majority had good performance status. There was almost an equal split between proximal and distal subtypes. Virtually all patients had loss of INI1, and over 60% had metastatic disease. On the left is the waterfall plot. On the right is the swimmer's plot. And I'll tell you that the response rates were somewhat modest at 15%. This is not dissimilar from what we see with cytotoxic chemotherapy, but what really got the field excited was the fact that about a quarter of patients had disease control after 6 months, which we do not see with conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy. Adverse events are shown here, generally well tolerated, very limited grade 3 or 4 adverse events, some hematologic toxicity and other things that are shown here, but generally speaking, a well tolerated therapy. So despite a modest response rate, the benefit here was really around disease control rate with a reasonable side effect profile, and this resulted in accelerated approval in 2020, again, for a disease state in which we were in desperate need of a valuable therapeutic approach. Now, we need to do a confirmatory study to get full FDA approval, and the FDA and regulatory authorities have mandated that we look at tazemetostat in combination with doxorubicin, which is our de facto frontline standard, compared to doxorubicin alone. So a phase 1b/3 study is underway. The phase 1b study was actually open to a variety of soft tissue sarcomas just to establish the dose. The phase 3 portion limited to folks with epithelioid sarcoma. The phase 1p portion has been already reported. The recommended phase 3 dose of TAS is 800 milligrams twice a day. And the side effect profile of the combination is not dissimilar from what we see with doxorubicin alone. So again, it's not clear that it adds much additional toxicity. So a lot of enthusiasm about this. This phase 3 study is going to be about 150 patients or so. I think it may be a little bit challenging to try to accrue it. We will see. We need to come together as a sarcoma community to try to get this done.
Of course, tazemetostat's approved in follicular lymphoma, and there they saw a greater benefit with people who had EZH2 mutant disease. Did they look at that here?
They do not. No, it's independent of mutational status.
All right, how about synovial sarcoma?
So this is a little bit more common than epithelioid sarcoma. It accounts for about 5 to 10% of our sarcomas. There are up to 1,000 cases diagnosed a year. And synovial sarcoma is what we call a translocation-associated sarcoma. It's characterized by a chromosomal translocation between chromosome X and 18. This is seen in the majority of patients. But what we've also identified is that these tumors actually have tumor antigen expression both for what's called MAGE-A4 and NY-ESO. And so efforts are underway to try to target these tumor-specific antigens for therapeutic effect. Similar to the CAR-T approach for hematologic malignancies, cellular products are now making their way into solid tumors, and sarcoma is really leading the way. Again, white cells are going to be isolated, the T cells are going to be isolated, they're going to be engineered to attack the antigen of choice. They're then expanded and reinfused into the patient after lymphodepleting chemotherapy. And in a phase one study that was published in Nature Medicine, there were a cohort of patients with synovial sarcoma, 16 to be exact, seven of which had evidence of partial response, so 44% response rate, which is far greater than anything that we see with conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy. This then led to an open-label phase two called the Spearhead Study. This was published in Lancet recently. Some of the information is here. This study actually enrolled both synovial sarcoma and a separate histology called myxoid liposarcoma. There were only 8 myxoid liposarcoma patients enrolled on this, so the vast majority were synovial sarcoma. You can see the majority had good performance status, and over 50% had 3 or more lines of therapy. Here's the waterfall plot, quite impressive. The response rates here were 37% or 39% for synovial sarcoma, 37% across the entire cohort, and you actually see on the far right a couple of complete responses. The spider plot is shown here, showing that if you have a response, that response can be quite durable. In terms of Kaplan-Meier, if you have a response, your survival is improved compared to those who did not. That's the blue line compared to the red line. The green line in the middle is the overall patient population. They looked at subgroup analyses. Any subgroup that they looked at appeared to benefit. This is with respect to response. And then side effects are shown here, not dissimilar than what many of you may see with your CAR-T approaches. So cytokine release syndrome, for example, cytopenia is related to the lymphodepleting chemotherapy. So a very promising therapy. It's important to note that there's a restricted HLA serotype for these patients, HLA O2. Even within that, there are some select types. So you have to have the MAGE-A4 expression. You have to have the appropriate HLA serotype. That accounts probably for about 25%, 20 to 25% of patients will be eligible. But very encouraging response rate with a reasonable side effect profile. Regulatory authorities looked at this and they approved it in August of 24, accelerated approval. Confirmatory study is underway. On the heels of this now, our strategy is looking at the other tumor antigen, NY-ESO. This is known as the IGNITE ESO study. This is, again, in a restricted HLA serotype for tumors expressing NY-ESO. Synovial sarcomas will express MAGE-A4 and NY-ESO. In fact, the majority will. This was an open-label phase 2 of 60 patients. The primary endpoint was overall response rate. This was reported at the Connective Tissue Oncology Society meeting late 24. And again, very impressive here. Overall response rates in excess of 40% with a number of complete responses. 6 total, 3 with synovial sarcoma, 3 with myxoid liposarcoma. And again, adverse events here, cytopenia is related to lymphodepletion and cytokine release syndrome and rash related to the T-cell infusion. So again, a promising approach. Just lastly, ongoing studies that are accruing nationally, we're looking at the incorporation of immunotherapy in the front line for patients with a specific type of sarcoma called UPS or undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma. We're comparing that with standard of care doxorubicin. Chondrosarcoma, which has no FDA-approved agents. We have a trial looking at a death receptor agonist. We're also looking at the use of IDH inhibitors for IDH mutant-positive disease. We're looking at intratumoral injections. We're looking at arginine depleters in leiomyosarcomas. We're looking at the role of chemotherapy for retroperitoneal disease. So I think the landscape is bright here. We surprisingly, I suppose, after decades of not having any success, we've had quite a bit of success in the last 5 to 7 years. based on us being a little bit smarter about how we run our clinical trials, this is leading to FDA approvals, it's leading to NCCN compendia listing, and a lot of excitement both for the use of tazemetostat in epithelioid sarcoma and cell-based strategies in synovial sarcoma.
I love talking to sarcoma people. They're like the Talmudic scholars of oncology. I can barely pronounce half of these drugs. All right, let's get back to a case in the real world here. So, Frank, you've got a 28-year-old man. What happened?
Yeah, so this is actually one of my favorite patients. He's a 28-year-old man that I met in the inpatient ward after I was consulted. 4th of July weekend, because he came in and he had a mass in the back of his thigh that had been there for a little while, but he hadn't really told anybody until 4th of July. He was at a pool party and somebody said, "What's that on the back of your thigh, on the back of your calf?" And so he came in with his wife and two young children. One was 5 and one was 10. He ended up having a chest x-ray when he showed up, and there were lung nodules on both lung fields. On exam, he had this really ugly, veiny, large, maybe 15-centimeter mass that was overlying his gastroc, and when he flexed his muscle, this thing you could feel was independent of it. It wasn't attached to it. He had no limitations of motion of the joint. He ended up getting a biopsy of both the mass and one of the lung nodules. We did this in coordination with the Moffitt sarcoma surgeon. And the pathology was consistent with an alveolar soft part sarcoma. And, you know, in preparing for this, I went back and I looked at my notes from 2011, and my notes usually reflect my state of mind. And I remember I wrote, "This is a very sad, unfortunate case of a great young man who has a terrible disease." And I remember at that time thinking, like, I'm going to have to see this guy through this course with young kids and a young wife, and he's going to die, you know, rapidly. So he ended up getting sunitinib first, and he did that for maybe, I think it was about 6 weeks. We had some repeat scans, and Moffitt being involved, they were actually very helpful, decided that we needed to switch him to MAI because he was not responding. So he got 6 cycles of MAI like a champ. He had no problems other than one episode of neutropenic fever, but the disease didn't budge. And the mass was there, it wasn't growing, his lung nodules were not changing. And after that, we put him on pasopinib, 800 milligrams daily. He had some issue with his liver enzymes, but in general did very well. He had a very nice response in his lungs. His calf mass never really went away, but it softened. It was clearly different, and he felt the same. He didn't really have any issues. He lost all the pigment in his body while on pasopinib. It was actually kind of neat to see. He was white from, you know, stem to stern. And in 2017, we did a next-generation sequencing on his original tumor, and all it showed was a KMT2C mutation. He was microsatellite stable and TMB low. He remained stable on pasopinib until the end of 2019, when he started to progress both in the lungs and in the calf. And at that point, again, with the guidance from tertiary care center, we switched him to pembro. I would have had no idea what to do with this young man. And he's been fantastic on pembro now for 5 years, and he couldn't be happier. When I met him, he was dressed from, you know, head to toe in University of Miami gear, and his daughter just entered the University of Miami, and so it's been a big celebration for him, and I'm very happy that he's had such a manageable course so far.
Any issues with the pembro? Any autoimmune problems?
Zero. He's been stellar. He hasn't had any problems. But I do have some questions regarding that mutation, that KMT2C mutation, whether or not, if seen in other sarcomas, does it predict response to immunotherapy? Are there other sarcomas that could benefit from immunotherapy? And really have some issues regarding local management of his calf mass, but if we can start with the immunotherapy question, it would be helpful.
Rashmi?
Sure. So the benefit of immunotherapy in this disease is probably more based on the histology base. So alveolar soft part sarcoma has been studied. Atezolizumab was a study that was performed, which was really a great triumph to be able to perform a study specifically in this histology and showed enough benefit to get drug approval. There are some other studies of immunotherapy, including with pembrolizumab, axitinib, which show an extraordinary affinity of these tumors to respond to immunotherapy greater than other histologies. And this just tells you the, you know, importance of histology-specific care. You know, if you think of most patients with metastatic sarcoma, your life expectancy, you're thinking on the order of 2 years. Alveolar soft part sarcoma is a relatively indolent, but usually frustrating disease. But now we have a lot more agents. We know that they're uniquely sensitive to TKIs as well as immunotherapy. I haven't seen that mutation very often, you know, a few times maybe in phalloides, but I don't think that's necessarily predictive. It's more, it's a translocation-associated histology, and I think it's the histology itself that lends for sensitivity to the immunotherapy. Typically not responsive to cytotoxic chemotherapy, so most of us don't even try at this point.
Yeah, it would have been good to know. So if he progresses on pembro, haven't seen pasopinib and sunitinib, what would you do next?
Rich?
You had mentioned that he was on pembro for 5 years. I would probably consider taking a break in pembro, to be quite honest. We, at least in our practice, we will stop at 2 years, and, and we can often have durable responses. If they were to progress, I would certainly consider atezolizumab, FDA-approved currently, which is one of the reasons why I would probably consider taking a break, just to have some time away from checkpoint inhibition in the event that you need to have it in the future. I agree with Rashmi that we don't typically use conventional cytotoxic chemotherapy at all. So we're looking at multi-targeted TKI, or we're looking at immunotherapy. For translocation-associated sarcoma, which Rashmi had mentioned that this is, it's unusual to identify any sort of other actionable changes. If the patient does progress in the thigh, I would radiate. But we're a little bit challenged otherwise.
Yeah, would you have radiated in the beginning with his original presentation? He wasn't having symptoms, but I mean, clearly he had, I was worried about venous obstruction, DVTs, et cetera.
We have a patient with ASPS in the calf who got radiated, and we radiated because re-irradiated because the time frame was long enough to allow it to do that. We also considered cryo to that as well.
Is there a size limitation for cryo? I mean, this thing's big and it's right next to his artery and vein.
Yeah, those two things may be a challenge.
Okay.
Size and proximity to blood vessels are scare our radiologists.
Rashmi, any interest in cell-free DNA, MRD-type assays in sarcomas? We're seeing this in a lot of other solid tumors.
Yeah, the data is fairly limited right now. Most of the data on circulating tumor DNA is with GI stromal tumors, which is helpful because we're learning more and more about how to guide our treatments based on mutation. And so by using that, we can sometimes, you know, not only evaluate for response, but also to just, you know, see if the mutation is sensitive to the drug of choice that we're going to move to next. But we are not lucky enough to get to an MRD status. Usually if we don't pick up anything, we just don't think we have enough circulating cells that we can detect.
Interesting. Frank, any other questions? You know, I was just thinking about this case, and, you know, I love to ask people, when was the last time somebody said to you, why are you in oncology? Isn't it depressing?
Oh, yeah.
And you know, I guess this is an example of when it's not depressing.
Yeah, it's, you know, I tell people all the time, you can't really know what sweet tastes like until you've tasted sour. And so seeing this, it makes the rest of your life, the rest of their life, kind of gets put on perspective, you know. So it's, I think it's, we have a unique opportunity as medical oncologists to experience life very close to the edge, and it really is a gift. It comes with some baggage, but it really is a gift, particularly if you're doing sarcoma, I would think.
So just a couple more minutes. You had a number of questions you had sent in to me that you wanted to hear them discuss in terms of liquid biopsy, new therapies, neoadjuvant treatment, anything they want to throw out to them.
Actually, I had a question that I didn't send to you. I just thought about it. But, you know, with so many different histologies, is the sarcoma community looking at molecular profiling or genomic profiling as commonalities that then can be used to accrue patients to clinical trials based on those commonalities, as opposed to having to, you know, wrangle 80 patients with these rare diseases to do a clinical trial?
Rashmi?
Most of the time, the molecular abnormality is also histology defining. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of histologies that are defined by the chromosomal translocation. So we use that for diagnostic purposes. Mm-hmm. More and more, we're trying to use it for therapeutic purposes. So for instance, Ewing sarcoma is one that's a translocation-associated sarcoma that has been historically difficult to target, that particular target. But now we're learning different ways to target different transcription factors that are encoded by these unusual fusions. So we're not necessarily looking at the molecular as a guidance, but we're looking at the histology and using the molecular to confirm the histology, because sometimes it is difficult to make just the correct pathologic diagnosis.
That makes sense. And in this case, for example, if this patient had not had metastatic disease, are you taking the data that you have from metastatic disease and applying to maybe neoadjuvant? So in his case, would you have given him a tezo? Let's say the disease was confined to the calf. Would you have given a tezo as a neoadjuvant approach to try to maximize his chances for margin-free resection?
Ashmi?
That's an interesting question. I will tell you, most patients with alveolar soft part sarcoma are diagnosed with metastatic disease at presentation. That's just kind of a known entity with these diseases. They're slow-growing, indolent, and most of the time they have metastatic lung disease. But I guess if I did see somebody with localized disease at presentation, I would probably go for the gold and go for resection rather than kind of, try to do a therapy, which, you know, is very successful in your patient, but unfortunately the response rates are not universal with this disease.
Yeah.
Definitely some entities were bringing some of our metastatic treatments earlier in the lineup, but they have to demonstrate a significant enough benefit in the metastatic setting to justify that.
Sure, makes sense.
Final comment from Rich.
No, I at least with respect to that question, I agree. We would treat it like a standard soft tissue sarcoma. We would give preoperative radiation therapy followed by surgical resection and then watch. The use of neoadjuvant therapy is best reserved for a clinical trial.
Yeah, got it. Thank you.
So you know what the theme for this weekend is: all day. We're going to do it all day. Just stay right out there. We're going to keep going. Thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to take a quick lunch break. Thanks so much.